And now, if we may return to an angle concerning Harvey Lee Oswald, to round out one phase of his life and to give us an insight into his character. It so happened that NBC's Joseph Michaels, who is a New York reporter with NBC now, was stationed in Russia in 1959. He knows a great deal about this man. As a matter of fact, he has interviewed a man who knows H. Lee Oswald very well. Here is Joseph Michaels in New York.
The man I talked to, Carlos Brinquier, a Cuban, knows Oswald much better than he'd like to, as a matter of fact, Morgan. We can talk about Russia a bit later if you like. Right now, I'm interested in Oswald, the double agent. Carlos Brinquier lives in New Orleans. I think the best thing to do is just to run the conversation as we held it a few moments ago.
Mr. Brinquier, you are a member of the Cuban Students Directorate in New Orleans, is that right?
Yes, sir. I am the local delegate here in New Orleans.
What does your organization do?
Well, we are an underground organization, an exile organization of students who are fighting against Castro communism, and we are raiding installations in Havana and trying to free Cuba.
I understand that you have had some contact with Mr. Oswald. Is this right?
That's right. You are right.
When did this take place?
Well, this started in the beginning of August this year. Mr. Oswald came to my office here in the city of New Orleans and offered me his service as ex-Marine of the United States to fight against Castro, or to train us to fight against Castro.
What did he say he could do for you?
Well, he said that he has a lot of experience as ex-Marine, and if in any moment we need persons to fight against Castro, he could fight by himself. Or if not, he can show us how to fight because he has a guerrilla training and all those things.
What did he say was his interest in helping you?
Because he seen that communism was a bad thing, and he was to see Cuba free from Castro.
Did he say any nasty things about Castro?
Yeah, he told bad things about Castro at that moment.
And what did he ask you for anything?
Well, no, he didn't ask me for anything. He gave to me a book, a guidebook for Marines, with his name in the top of the first page, telling to me that that book could help us to be trained to fight against Castro. He was interested in the Cuban Student Directorate organization, but as a revolutionary organization, we never talked too much with a person who really we don't know.
What do you mean he was interested? How did he show his interest?
Well, because he said that he knows that the Cuban Student Directorate was making raids in Cuba and was infiltrating people in Cuba, and he was he will be glad to work with us.
Now, did you meet him? Did you ever see him again?
Yes, sir. About 3 days later, one Cuban came to my office and told me that there was a person distributing propaganda in the 700 block of Canal Street, which is the main street here in New Orleans. We went over there. That was the August 9th, 1963. And we went over there, and I was shocked when I found that the same guy who was distributing the pro-communist propaganda in Canal Street was Lee H. Oswald.
You couldn't have been mistaken?
Pardon?
I said, you couldn't have been mistaken about this?
No. I wasn't no mistake. And when he saw me, he smiled and tried to salute me. But I was really shocked and really angry because he had a sign telling Viva Fidel, hand off Cuba, and distributing some papers from the Fair Play for Cuba committee, because he was something that I knew later, that he was at that moment the chairman of the Fair Play for Cuba committee here in New Orleans.
At the same time that he was trying to infiltrate your organization?
Pardon? The same guy, exactly, the same person.
And at the same time?
At the same time, that's right.
What happened after that?
Well, we had trouble over there because we broke his propaganda and we threw it away. In one moment, I was trying to hit him, but he crossed his arms down and told me, okay, Carlos, if you want to hit me, hit me. I thought in that moment that if I would hit him, he would appear as a victim and that he was trying that I hit him.
Uh-huh.
In case I didn't hit him and the police came and brought all of us to the prison here in the city, the first district here in the city, and we paid a bond of $25 each one.
Did you ever see him again?
Well, yes. 3 days later, we appeared in the second municipal court here in New Orleans, and in the trial, the judge dismissed the charges against us and fined him in $10 for disturbing the peace. He paid the fine and went free.
And was that the end of your connection with him?
No, sir. A few days later, one newsman, Bill Stocky, from here from New Orleans, contacted me because he wanted to know his address, the Oswald addresses, and I gave him, and the newsman told me that he will make an interview of Mr. Oswald. I disagreed with the newsman, and I told him that I prefer to have a debate, because having a debate, we can show both parts of history. And the newsman agreed with me, and we held the debate on August 21st, 1963, at WDSU Radio here in New Orleans.
Yes, that's the debate that we have already heard on NBC.
That's right.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Brinkier.
You are welcome. I am sorry very much as Cuban about what happened.
God bless you. Thank you.
Well, Joe Michaels, that interview you had a few minutes ago with the Cuban anti-Castro man is... I think the title of it should be The Double Agent Exposed. But now, your experience, Joe, with Oswald, oddly enough, goes back much further. Much further.
Yes.
You were NBC's correspondent in Moscow in 1959. The man went there in 57. He stayed 2 years. And we've heard a great deal about why he left or why he did not become a Russian citizen and so on. I wonder if you couldn't throw considerable light on that.
Well, I can throw some light on it anyway. I have here from my own files an item called Harvey Lee Oswald Defector from 31st October 1959, and I'll read that to you.
Now, wait a minute. This is an item that you wrote at that time in Moscow?
This is an item I broadcast to NBC at that time. I said, a 20-year-old former Marine from Texas has come to Moscow with the proclaimed intention of becoming a Soviet citizen. Harvey Lee Oswald of 4936 Collingwood Avenue in Fort Worth informed the American Embassy here that he has applied to the Supreme Soviet of the USSR for Soviet citizenship. Oswald has not as yet renounced his American citizenship, but when embassy officials spoke to him, he was apparently quite firm about his decision. Oswald was recently discharged from the Marine Corps, the only job he has ever held, and immediately, it seems, came to the Soviet Union, arriving here on the 15th of this month. He is still, that is at that time, in Moscow, but so far has not been prepared to talk with members of the press. Now, shortly after that, on November 23rd, it was less than that. It was just a couple of days after that. One correspondent did manage to talk to him, and that was Aline Mosby of UPI.
And that was, again, still in 1959.
That was, I think, the next day or the day after. Aline has written about it again. She was, I guess, able to get in because Aline is an extremely attractive young woman, and he probably didn't expect any women. He had already rejected a couple of correspondents. He lived at that time in the same hotel at which I was staying, by the way, at the Hotel Metropole. I was not able to get in. Aline says, looking back at her notes, that the same thing that I have written here, but that she went in and talked to him, and she said he talked to her very easily, and he was an intense young man. She said that she deemed him at the time very determined, but unsure of himself, naive, and emotionally unbalanced. He said that Soviet officials had informed him that either in the event of acceptance or rejection of his first application, he would not have to leave Moscow. Now, an interesting sidelight on that is that the general consensus is that the Russians didn't want him either. The Russians had some experience with defectors who changed their minds. And by the time Oswald came along, they probably judged him unbalanced, too. And even if he was a sympathizer and proclaimed himself a communist, they didn't care for his type. Men who defect once, of course, can defect again. And so therefore, it is my belief, and was the belief of people at the embassy at the time, and other correspondents with some experience, that Oswald was refused the citizenship which he had requested from the Russians. By the way, I do know at the time that embassy spokesmen thought him at first just a naive young man and spoke to him very strongly and in fatherly fashion about what he was getting himself into. But he was determined, and America, unlike Russia, does not try to force people to stay American citizens. We would be, of course, substantially better off were Harvey Lee Oswald not one.
A very curious coincidence. I've forgotten the name of the young man who here in New York, as you may recall, wanted to become a Russian-type communist. He applied very hard to them, and they made quite a considerable inquiry about him. It was about 3 or 4 years ago, and after a certain length of time, they thought they could use him as an agent, and then they decided he was no good as an agent because he was, shall we say, a screwball. Mm-hmm. He was not to be trusted in any language,
either
as an agent or anything else, and he went to Cuba. The same kind of affection seems to have fastened itself upon this man here.
A fellow
who was rejected by the Russians, then fastened upon Fidel Castro as the great hero, the messiah of the future. A very curious angle. Huh?
He had a very unhappy time of it in the Marine Corps, which in itself says nothing particularly, but in this case perhaps adds up with the weight of the evidence to show a disturbed, unbalanced, unhappy, and rather miserable creature.
A very interesting commentary. I'm sure if you were still in Moscow, you would be up as of Saturday morning Moscow time right now, along with a lot of other correspondents. I'd like to point out that we're beginning to receive dispatches concerning Premier Nikita Khrushchev from Moscow. The Soviet government seems to have gone out of its way, and I say gone out of its way, to report the Premier's action, because they never, never stay up late to help reporters with information unless they have a specific reason to do so. Isn't that about right, Joe? We have a report now concerning Premier Khrushchev. Saturday morning dateline, our second Saturday morning dateline from the European zone of correspondence. Premier Khrushchev is rushing back to Moscow by special train from the Ukraine. He had been there a few days, reasons unknown, but presumably on the agricultural crisis in Russia. He is rushing back because of the assassination of President Kennedy. That has been conveyed to the reporters by the Russian government. And the Soviet leader has ordered Foreign Minister Gromyko to stand by to go to Washington to attend President Kennedy's funeral. And the newspaper Pravda has now been ordered to remake its front page on Saturday morning to eulogize the late president as a man of peace, who was working, and we quote exactly what Pravda is saying, who was working toward a healthier international situation. And we'll be back with more about Russia in a few moments.
The NBC radio network will stay on the air with continuous coverage until 1 o'clock a.m. Eastern Standard Time. We will resume broadcasting at 7:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time Saturday tomorrow with continuous coverage. We pause 10 seconds for station identification.
The Detroit News Stations, WWJ and WWJFM Detroit.
And now we resume coverage of the situation in Moscow. As we've noted, Premier Khrushchev was out of the capital in the Ukraine, where he's been attending to some of the problems of the agricultural crisis in Russia. Andrei Gromyko personally telephoned United States Ambassador Foy D. Kohler, as reported to you earlier. It was midnight Moscow time, 4 p.m. Friday, to express the shock and the greatest sympathy to the American people. He said condolences will be conveyed later at the highest level. And obviously he meant Mr. Khrushchev. And now he's got orders to come to Washington, Andrei Gromyko, Foreign Minister of the Soviet Union, to convey the condolences of the Russian government. Obviously, Mr. Khrushchev wants it known very definitely that the friendly spirit of the Soviet Union that appeared in the nuclear test ban treaty has not been abandoned, even though we've had trouble in Berlin and elsewhere with him since then. And now it's time, I believe, ladies and gentlemen, to point out that the White House has been a somberly, somberly busy place ever since President Kennedy was shot at 12:30 Central Standard Time today. Many hours have elapsed. Much has happened that will go into the history books of this country in extended fashion. Let us, therefore, at this time, have a resume, a recapitulation of what went on at the White House on this day. We take you to Richard Valeriani at the White House in Washington.
The White House is all but empty tonight. President Lyndon Johnson, who arrived here just 4 hours after President Kennedy was assassinated, worked until a few minutes ago in his vice presidential offices on the second floor of the Executive Office Building across the street from the White House. He is now in his own home in the district to spend the night. The widow of the slain president, Mrs. Jacqueline Kennedy, and his brother, Attorney General Robert Kennedy, are reportedly spending the night at Bethesda Naval Hospital, where the coffin bearing President Kennedy's body was taken. There is no word on where the Kennedy children are at this hour. There is uncertainty whether or not the coffin will be brought to the East Room of the White House tonight or tomorrow. A presidential aide says that it will remain at the hospital all night, but a priest from St. Matthew's Cathedral, where a pontifical requiem mass will be held Monday, said the casket will be brought to the White House sometime after midnight. It will be on view tomorrow for members of the family, President Johnson, cabinet members, and other high-ranking officials of the government. Arrangements for the funeral are being handled by the director of the Peace Corps, Sergeant Shriver, the late president's brother-in-law. For tomorrow's viewing, the casket will be flanked by two silver candle holders and by a kneeling rail. Three busloads of an all-service honor guard in dress uniform have arrived at the White House, presumably to stand guard at President Kennedy's casket when it arrives. Before President Johnson left, the White House announced that he will meet with Secretary of State Dean Rusk at 9:30 tomorrow morning and with former President Eisenhower at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning. President Johnson also discussed with FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover the investigation of the assassination. He also talked with a doctor attending Governor Connally of Texas, who was wounded by the same sniper who killed the president. The governor's condition was reported as good. Earlier, President Johnson conferred with security officials, with Defense Secretary McNamara, and with McGeorge Bundy, a White House security advisor. He also met with legislative leaders who assured him of bipartisan support. Here at the White House now, crowds are still waiting across the street on Pennsylvania Avenue, waiting as though they still didn't believe the terrible news. This is Richard Valeriani, NBC News, at the White House in Washington.
And now I think it's a matter of major interest, the reaction in Moscow. It is curious that early Saturday morning, long after dispatches were available in Moscow about H. Lee Oswald, the American communist-oriented young citizen, long after those dispatches reached Moscow, early Saturday morning, a Moscow radio commentator has again connected the shooting of the President of the United States with, quote, extreme rightists in this country. He said at the time he was shot, President Kennedy was carrying the text of a speech which would have condemned the ultra-right-wing groups. And it is quite true, and TASS reporters were well justified, that the president's speech that he would have given later today, we've read parts of it to you, did carry in it certain context to indicate that he was going to at least appeal to right-wing elements of this country to stop their course of action, which appeared to him to be reckless. But the curious part about these dispatches from Moscow early Saturday morning is that they persist in calling this assassination, or labeling it, an assassination by extreme rightists in the United States. They appear not to wish to get out of their minds that the rightists, so far as anybody knows at this time, had nothing to do with it. As a matter of fact, their greatest enemies in the United States had something to do with it, if anybody did, beyond Mr. Oswald, the Texan. About 100 Russian students gathered in front of the American embassy shortly after midnight tonight in Moscow as word of the assassination spread. And one of these students told a passing American that Kennedy was another Lincoln. They wished very definitely, whether on orders or whether by their own wish, they wished very definitely to make it plain that they were friendly toward the United States and toward the President of the United States at this moment. Now, about that speech that the President would have delivered in Dallas, the beginning of the speech we've already read to you twice, It was an appeal to all Americans to unite and a suggestion, a very strong suggestion, that the greatest thing we could do would be to unite together into the space age and to remain strong. But he was going to make, as we now learn from reporters who were assigned to cover the Texas meetings of the president, we now learn the president tonight meant to attack, in his Dallas speech, to attack his right-wing critics. He intended to tell them that they were talking what he called just plain nonsense. This is the intention of the president of the United States before he was killed today. The theme of his speech that he's prepared or was prepared to deliver at the Dallas Trade Mart. He was on his way to the Trade Mart, and 2,500 diners were waiting him there when he was felled by an assassin's bullet just after noon. The undelivered speech hit very hard at some of the Kennedy opponents. President Kennedy was to have said in the speech that some Americans confuse rhetoric with reality and the plausible with the possible. He was to have said, these Americans offer seemingly swift and simple solutions to every world problem. That there are no such solutions in his view. But the president meant to offer no apologies for his own policies to conservatives who oppose him. He declared that the country, or he would have declared in this speech, that the country is stronger than ever before at this time and has the military and the scientific and economic muscle to do whatever must be done for the preservation and promotion of freedom and free countries. Now, at the place where the president was to have spoken, as we noted, 2,500 diners were waiting. And, of course, they had to be informed of the tragic accident on the road, the assassination of the president. The Reverend Luther Holcomb was chosen to step to the microphone and inform the 2,500 Texans that the president would never be able to address them. He did so in halting terms, and then he raised his face and he looked toward heaven and said, O God, we are relying upon the faith that we possess to see us through this most difficult period. There were audible sobs all over the room at the mark. And there were whispers as soon as the moment of shock and grief or unbelief had passed. Then the crowds bowed heads in silence. A week ago yesterday, on Thursday, on November the 14th, to be exact, President Kennedy held his last news conference. If I recollect correctly, this was a conference that was held in the morning in response to requests by afternoon papers. You know, even some of the conservative newspapers that criticized the president for managing the news were among those who asked that they be given a shot at a presidential news conference. In other words, they didn't confuse their political beliefs with the power of a presidential headline, whether it be President Kennedy or President Eisenhower or who. And so the president held a morning news conference. I believe it was this one. And it occurred to us that at this time, you would like to hear the president of the United States on his last meeting with the reporters, his last direct and informal contact with the people of this country through the newsmen who cover Washington on radio, television, and for the press. It so happened that on that day, NBC's Robert Goralski introduced the late president at his last news conference.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Morning, gentlemen, ladies. Come in. Yes.
How menacing do you regard the Cambodian threat to reject our foreign aid? Can that country be slipping into the communist orbit, do you believe?
Well, I regard it as serious. It's my hope that Prince Sihanouk, who must be concerned about the independence and the sovereignty of his country, he has, after all, been involved for many years in maintaining that independence, will not decide at this dangerous point in the world's affairs to surrender it. I would think that he's more concerned about Cambodian independence than we are. After all, he's a Cambodian. So that my judgment is that in the long run, that he will protect that independence. It would be folly not to, and I don't think he's a foolish man.
Mr. President, how do you regard the case involving Professor Barghorn, and what are we doing about getting his release from the Russian government?
You know, the American ambassador, the United States Embassy, has made six protests to the Soviet government in the last 48 hours. Ambassador Kohler has been to the Soviet Foreign Ministry personally. The United States government is deeply concerned about the unwarranted and unjustified arrest of Professor Barghorn by the fact that he was held for a number of days without the United States being informed of it, and that the United States officials in the Soviet Union have not had an opportunity to visit with him. He was not on an intelligence mission of any kind. He's a distinguished professor of Soviet affairs. He's played a most helpful and constructive role in arranging cultural exchanges, scientific exchanges. We're concerned not only for his personal safety, but because this incident, I think, can have a most serious effect upon what we understood the Soviet government's strong hope, and was certainly our hope, we would find a widening of cultural, intellectual exchanges. We've heard from a good many universities and private organizations which have expressed their alarm, who've been taking part in these exchanges, and it's quite clear that the professor's early release is essential if these programs are to be continued. I can assure you that the Department of State, our embassy in Moscow, will do everything it can to affect the early release of the professor. His arrest is unjustified. I repeat again, he was not on an intelligence mission of any kind. I'm hopeful that this will become quickly obvious to the Soviet Union that they will release him.
Mr. President.
Yes, Ms. Gallagher.
Some persons view Professor Barghorn's arrest as a sign the Soviets are now deliberately seizing innocent Americans with the aim of later swapping them for some of their convicted espionage agents, or that the Soviets may be doing this with the hope of somehow extracting political concessions from us. How would you view any such tactics?
Well, I wouldn't think that, obviously they would not be successful. I wouldn't attempt to make a judgment as to the conduct of the Soviet Union or what may motivate it from week to week, day to day. But I'm certainly, it's quite obvious that if it's based on the presumptions you state, that it's will not be successful.
Mr. President?
Yes?
What are the prerequisites or conditions for resumption of some form of trade with Red China?
We're not planning to trade with Red China in view of the policy that Red China pursues. If the Red Chinese indicate a desire to live at peace with the United States, with other countries surrounding it, then quite obviously the United States would reappraise its policies. We're not wedded to a policy of hostility to Red China. It seems to me Red China's policies are what create the tension between not only the United States and Red China, but between Red China and India, between Red China and our immediate neighbors to the south, and even between Red China and other communist countries.
Mr. President?
Yes.
The President, now seems unlikely that you will get either your tax bill or your civil rights bill in this session of Congress. Does that disturb you?
Oh, I think that the longer they're delayed, I think that, I think it is unfortunate. The fact of the matter is that both these bills should be passed. The tax bill has been before the Congress for nearly a year. Civil rights has been there for a much shorter time, didn't go up till June. And I'm hopeful that the House will certainly act on that in the next month, maybe sooner. The tax bill, the hearings have been quite voluminous. It seemed to me that it might be possible to end those hearings and bring the matter to the floor of the Senate before the end of the year. Otherwise, civil rights bill will come over after the first of the year. There may be a very long debate. The tax bill may be caught up in that. I suppose some people are hopeful that that's so, but I'm not. And I think that the economy will suffer. The economy will suffer, and I think that I certainly would not want to be responsible for that. Therefore, we'd like to get the tax bill out of the way quickly and this important piece of legislation. I would think the members of Congress would.
President, there have been published reports that General Harkins may have lost his usefulness in Vietnam because of his identification with the Diem regime and lack of contacts with the new generals running the country. Would you care to comment on that?
I think it's wholly untrue. I have complete confidence in him. He was just doing his job. I think he said in the interview yesterday he had seen Mr. New, I think, only three times. He'd seen President Zem on a number of occasions. That was his job. That was what he was sent for, to work with the government in power. That's what he will do with the new government. I have great confidence in General Hawkins. And there may be some who would like to see General Hawkins go, but I plan to keep him there.
Mr. President.
Yeah. Yes.
Following up that, sir, would you give us your appraisal of the situation in South Vietnam now since the coup and the purposes for the Honolulu Conference?
Well, because we do have a new situation and a new government. We hope a increased effort in the war. The purpose of the meeting in Honolulu, which Ambassador Lodge will be there, General Hawkins will be there, others, with Secretary McNamara and others, and then, as you know, later Ambassador Lodge will come here, is to attempt to assess the situation, what American policy should be, what our aid policy should be, how we can intensify the struggle, how we can bring Americans out of there. Now, that is our object, to bring Americans home, to permit the South Vietnamese to maintain themselves as a free and independent country, and permit the democratic forces within the country to operate, which they can, of course, much more freely when the assault from the inside, and which is manipulated from the north, is ended. So the purpose of the meeting in Honolulu is how to pursue these objectives. Yes.
Mr. President, Madam New has now left the United States but indicated that she intends to return. Will we renew her tourist visa?
Yes.
And if she asks for it, will we grant her permanent residence, perhaps as a political
Well, I think we waited, but it would certainly permit her to return to the United States if she wishes to do so.
Mr. President,
yes.
Year by year, the foreign aid program seems to encounter more and more resistance in the Congress, and this year we're seeing senators who ordinarily in the past have gone along with the program.
Yes, this is the worst attack on foreign aid that we've seen since the beginning of the Marshall Plan.
In the event that one of these years the Congress, the arguments for foreign aid notwithstanding, surprises itself by voting the program out, what would we then do?
I think it would be a great mistake. I think, of course, some of the difficulty is where the president sits and where the members of the Senate sit. Been said very many times, and I've never questioned it, that the Senate and the Congress have every right to decide how much money should be appropriated. That's their constitutional right. But on the other hand, the president bears particular responsibilities in the field of foreign policy. If there are failures in the Middle East, Africa, and Latin America, South Vietnam, Laos, it's usually not a senator who is selected to bear the blame, but it's the administration, the president of the United States. I regard this, President Eisenhower regarded, and President Truman. It's no coincidence that all three presidents, since this program began, and presidential candidates, Mr. Nixon, Mr. Stevenson, Governor Dewey, that all of them, Governor Rockefeller today, others, seems to me all recognize the importance of this program. It's because it's a very valuable arm of the United States in the field of foreign policy. I don't think it's recognized what an important influence this has. Now, we spend $51 or $52 billion on defense. We spend $2.5 billion on the atomic energy program. We spend $5 billion on space, of which at least a good percentage has a military implication in the sense of our national security. We spend all this money, and yet we're going to deny the President of the United States a very valuable weapon in maintaining the influence of the United States in this very diversified world. I can't imagine anything more dangerous than to end this program. I can assure you that whoever is President of the United States succeeding me will support this program. Now, the second point I want to make is that what we are now talking about is only a fourth of what we tried to do in the early 50s. When I said in the, I don't understand why we are suddenly so fatigued. I don't regard the struggle as over, and I don't think it's probably going to be over for this century. I think this is a continuing effort, and it's not a very heavy one. It's a fraction of our budget, a fraction of our gross national product. The gross national product of the United States has increased $100 billion. We'll have by the end of this year in 3-year period. So what we're asking is $1 billion less than in the average program since 47. The need today is greater. These countries are poorer. There's a good many more of them. And yet we're being denied. The President of the United States is being threatened with denying him a very important weapon and helping him meet his responsibility. The Congress has its responsibilities, but in the field of foreign policies, there are particular burdens placed on the president, whoever he may be. The Supreme Court, in the Curtis Wright, has said that the president is the organ of the country in the field of foreign policy. I just want to say, personally, as president, and my predecessor said the same, this program is essential to the conduct of our foreign policy. And therefore, I'm asking the Congress of the United States to give me the means of conducting the foreign policy of the United States. And if they do not want to do so, then they should recognize that they're severely limiting my ability to protect the interests of the country. That's how important I think this program is.
President, before you leave the subject, sir, would you comment just a bit further? It is still a fact that a negative action by a Congress is something that an administration has great difficulty in coping with.
Right.
Has the government looked ahead to that possibility and prepared against it?
No, I can't believe that the Congress of the United States is going to be so unwise unless we're going to retreat from the world. We're going to give up in South Vietnam. We're going to give up in Latin America. I've said before that what we're talking about in the case of Latin America and the Alliance for Progress, for all of Latin America, is what the Soviet Union and the bloc are putting into Cuba alone. Now, can you tell me the United States isn't able to do that? In addition, these amendments, which are passed because they don't like a particular leader or a particular national policy as of the moment, it's a very changing world. Because they don't like the fishing policy, we're going to decide that to end all aid, two or three countries in Latin America that are hard-pressed, rather than permitting us to negotiate the matter out. But anyway, as I say, they have their responsibilities and I have mine. I just tried to make it very clear that I cannot fulfill my responsibility in the field of foreign policy without this program. Now, the most important program, of course, is on national security, but don't the United States have to put troops there? What's going to happen in Laos if it collapses? They're going to blame the Senate or they're going to blame me? I know who they're going to blame. So I need this program. Yeah.
As a possible candidate for president, would you comment on the possible candidacy of Margaret Chase Smith and specifically what effect that would have on the New Hampshire primary?
I would think, as if I were a Republican candidate, I would not look forward to campaigning against Margaret Chase Smith in New Hampshire. Or as a possible candidate for president, I think she's very formidable, if that's the appropriate word to use about a very fine lady. She's a very formidable political figure.
President, getting back to Professor Barghorn for a moment, negotiations for a renewal of the exchange agreement with the Soviet Union were scheduled to begin next Tuesday, and now, as I understand it, have been postponed.
Correct.
Do those negotiations depend upon the release of Professor Barghorn?
I don't think it's helpful for the professor to try to put these conditions upon it. I just say that there's no sense having a program if a man who is innocent of any intelligence mission, which is true in this case, is subjected to arrest without means of defense. How can you carry on that kind of a program? I'm sure that everybody would agree that it would be hopeless under these conditions.
Mr. President, would you comment on the weak deal with the Soviet Union and tell us whether the Export-Import Bank or whether any other agency of government is doing more in this deal than it would for any friendly country?
No, it will not do more than it would for any friendly country. The matter is now in private negotiation, and I don't know what's going to happen on the deal. Yes, Mr. Smith.
Could you expand, sir, on the changes in the travel restrictions for Soviet diplomats? For example, in Oregon, there were five counties that were off limits during the past 2 years, and now it's been expanded to 13 counties. Could you expand on
that? In the case of the Soviet Union, 26% of their country are off limits to the United States, and we have put the same percentage of ours. If they would be willing to change that percentage and drop it, I think we would be willing to. Now, in the case of the bloc, we've attempted to put some limitations upon the travel of bloc military attachés because we feel that it's important to the security of the United States and to the alliance. The base of the alliance rests upon the nuclear forces of the United States. I think we have to protect their security. And the Defense Department felt very strongly that this was important to the security of the United States, or otherwise it would not have been done.
I think a few minutes ago you said it would be unfortunate if the tax bill and the civil rights bill don't get through. You just said also it's the worst attack on the foreign aid bill since its inception. Several appropriations bills are still hung up in Congress, the first time in history this late. What's happened on Capitol?
Well, they're all interrelated. I think that there's some delay because of civil rights. That's had an effect upon the passage of appropriation bills. There isn't any question. On the other hand, of course, what we're talking about in both the civil rights bill and the tax bill are very complicated and important pieces of legislation. More significant in their own way than legislation which has been sent up there for a decade. My judgment is that by the time this Congress goes home, in the sense of next summer, that in the fields of education, mental health, taxes, civil rights, this is going to be a record that's going to be, however dark looks now, I think that westward look, the land is bright, and I think by next summer it may be.
Mr. President.
Mr. Van Oker, we don't
hear very much.
Yes.
In view of what you just said, sir, you listed certain items. You didn't mention medical care for the aged.
Yes.
Now, even though Chairman Mills has promised to hold hearings this month, there doesn't seem to be any immediate prospect of clearing it. Since he was so helpful on the tax bill, are you prepared to ask him to cast his vote to get that out of committee so the House can vote on it?
I think that we're going to get that bill out of committee, but not this year, but next year, and I think we'll have a vote on it, and I think it will pass.
Mr. President.
But I don't think it will pass this year. I think it will next year. I think that's one of the... I didn't mean to make an exclusive list. I'm looking forward to the record of this Congress, but it may not come till... this is going to be an 18-month delivery.
Mr. President, the bill, the program put forward by this distinguished committee of private citizens, it seems to go farther than your bill on Medicare. Would you be prepared to sponsor a program, say, if Senator Javits joined with Senator Anderson in a bipartisan measure?
Yes, I'm going to meet with them, and I think that that bill recognized the principle of Social Security. I thought it was a very valuable job because it was a bipartisan. The committee was distinguished Republicans on it as well as Democrats. I'm meeting with Senator Anderson, Senator Javits, and I think that this offers us a good deal of hope for that bill. I think they've given it new life. Mr. Kenworthy?
Part of the disenchantment on Capitol Hill over foreign aid seems to stem from the feeling that the administration hasn't fully used the flexibility it asks. For example, on aid to Indonesia when President Sukarno was threatened Malaysia.
Mr. Kenworthy, we've suspended the aid to Indonesia.
But haven't suspended it, have you, Mr. President, to the United Arab Republic, which is defying the UN in
In the case of Indonesia, though, we are suspending it. It seems to me it's much better. I don't know what the situation is going to be 3 months from now in regard to relations between Indonesia and Malaysia. I hope they are better. What is the possible use of passing a prohibition against assistance to Indonesia because of its attitude towards Malaysia when 3 months from now it may or may not be the same as it is today? That's the point. Now, in the United Arab Republic, the United States, as you know, 80% of its assistance consists of 80% of its assistance consists of food, surplus food. We have been working to try to get a withdrawal, an orderly withdrawal, in the case of the Yemen. There has not been a conflict, I think a good deal as a result of effort which we and others have made, between Saudi Arabia and the UAR. I am concerned about the Yemen because the rate of the withdrawal, of course, has been quite limited. There are going to be further withdrawals by January, but unless those withdrawals are consistent with earlier statements, I would think that the chance of increased tension between the UAR and Saudi Arabia would substantially increase. But I don't think, Mr. Kenworthy, that the language that the Senate adopted, which calls upon me to make a finding which is extremely complicated to make, is particularly strengthens our hands or our flexibility in dealing with the UAR. In fact, it will have the opposite result. These countries are poor. I'm not now talking about the UAR, most of them. These threats from the United States, they're going to cut off all aid. There's a great temptation to fire in the country to say, cut it off. I mean, they're nationalists, they're proud, they're, in many cases, radical. I don't think threats from Capitol Hill bring the result, which are frequently hoped. Quiet work may not bring it, but I think there's a great temptation to say, at the time when the Aswan Dam was cut off, that didn't bring the Arab Republic to follow us. It
produce the opposite result. I'm afraid these other threats. I think it's a very dangerous, untidy world, but we're going to have to live with it. And I think one of the ways to live with it is to permit us to function. And if we don't function, the voters will throw us out, but not to make it impossible for us to function by legislative restraints or inadequate appropriations.
Mr. Yeah. President, in view of congressional sentiment toward the Alliance for Progress program, is your administration going to make any special effort to persuade the government of Argentina not to nationalize American-owned oil companies?
Well, as you know, Governor Harriman visited the Argentine, discussed the matter. It's now in negotiation. What we're concerned about is if action is taken, that there be adequate machinery for compensation, fair compensation. We can't deny the sovereign right of a country to take action within its borders, but we can insist that there be equitable standards for compensating those whose property are taken away from them. We are attempting to work this out with the Argentine, but the Argentine is faced, as all of Latin America, with staggering problems. They've emerged from a military hunter, Peronism, and all the rest, and democratic election, and this was one of the commitments that were made, so now we attempt to adjust our interests. But we are concerned about the oil in Argentina and in Peru. Yes, excuse me, Mr. Mayor.
You were quoted as saying you were very satisfied with the vote in Philadelphia. Why were you satisfied?
Because Mayor Tate was elected. As John Bailey said, the Republicans had the statistics and we the officers, so that's why I was satisfied. Yeah.
The Fred Korth and Bobby Baker cases have prompted some serious questions about the moral and ethical climate in Washington. What is your assessment of today's climate in Washington?
Well, I think it's always... first place, I don't lump the two cases together. I think there are differences between the two cases. I want to make that... I want to make that clear. So there are differences between the cases. Now, if you're talking about... there are always bound to be in the government, newspaper business, labor, and so on, farmers, there are always going to be people who can't stand the pressure of opportunity, so that what the important point is what action is taken against them. And I think that this administration has been very vigorous in its action, and I think that we've tried to set a responsible standard. There's always going to be people that fail to meet that standard, then we attempt to take appropriate action dealing with each case. But Mr. Baker is now being investigated, and I think we'll know a good deal more about Mr. Baker before we're through. Other people may be investigated as time goes on. We just try to do the best we can, and I think that the governmental standards, let me say, on the whole, I think compare favorably with those in Washington, with those some other parts of America.
Last week, Mr. President, the Soviet Union in Moscow showed what they claimed was an anti-missile missile. I wonder if you could tell us what you know about that missile. Is it what they claim it is supposed to be? And also, what is the effectiveness of their anti-missile system?
Well, I don't think it's probably useful to discuss it in detail here. I don't think there's any doubt that they have an anti-missile missile, as do we. The problem, of course, however, is what you deal with saturation. And I don't think that the Soviet Union or the United States have solved the problem of dealing, as I've said before, with a whole arsenal of missiles coming at us at maximum speed with the decoys. That's the impossible. That, up till now, has been the impossible task.
Mr. President, we seem to be in somewhat of a stalemate on recognizing the new regimes in two Latin American countries, the Dominican Republic and Honduras. I'm wondering, the administration perhaps has been reluctant to tell these countries precisely what they had to do to get recognition.
No, we've had discussions with both countries. As you know, this is not just a matter of the United States. This is a matter of nearly the whole hemisphere. In fact, by a vote of 18-1, the OAS voted to have a meeting on the problem of military coups. We've attempted to indicate inquire what steps each of these two countries, the governments of the two countries, are prepared to take to return to constitutional government, which we regard as the most desirable form of government and also the one that would be most effective in meeting the challenges of the hemisphere. So we've inquired of both of them what steps they're prepared to take, when elections would be, who would be in the government. So we've been working very assiduously.
In general terms, sir, could you say whether we would be prepared to accept the same conditions for recognition there that we did in the case of the junta in Peru? Elections within 1 year, for example?
Well, I think it'd be unwise to attempt to negotiate it out here, but we did
recognized the Hunter in Peru on the assurances that they would hold elections. They did hold them, and the result was very fair, so that it shows that it can be done. That's what we'd like to see done in these countries.
Yes, President, to go back to the Russian-American problem, given the fact that our relations seem to alternate between hot and cold, the Barghorn case and the Audubon at the moment, what do you say to those Americans who say that in such a situation we should not sell wheat to the Soviet Union, or certainly not without trying to use it as a method of, say, negotiating some better arrangement on the Audubon?
Well, I think the wheat deal is desirable for us, desirable for the Soviet Union. I'm not convinced it may mean $200 million in balance of payments for us. It means wheat to the Soviet Union. But in view of the supplies that the Soviet Union have in its own country, in Australia and Canada, this I'm not sure that the wheat can carry other loads. I think it pretty much stands on its own. It's of some benefit to us, some benefit to the Soviet Union, but this idea that other things can be hitched onto it. But the we are, quite obviously, this kind of trade that depends upon a reasonable atmosphere in both countries. I think that atmosphere has been badly damaged by the Boghorn arrest. In the case of the Audubon, this is a continuing matter over a good many years. We're going to maintain our rights in Berlin, and we've made that quite clear. I expect that we're going to have difficulties, and the Soviet Union may have difficulties in other matters. But Professor Boghorn, I regard as a very serious matter.
President,
yes, Mr. Raymond,
do you feel that you have a firm commitment from the Republicans in the House leadership to back and support in the Rules Committee and on the floor every provision in the compromise bill approved by the House?
I wouldn't want to speak for them. I think they ought to speak for themselves. I will say that a substantial part of that bill bears Republican language and imprint. Wouldn't have been passed without their support. It is a bill which is Republican and Democratic. I think it's a bill which is bipartisan. I would hope it would have it can't pass without bipartisan support. I would hope it would be able to maintain it on the floor of the House, because if we don't, we're not even going to get it through the House.
President,
yes, Raymond.
In view of the changed situation in South Vietnam, do you still expect to bring back 1,000 troops before the end of the year, or has that figure been raised and lowered?
No, we're going to bring back several hundred before the end of the year. But I think on the question of the exact number, I thought we'd wait till the meeting of November 20th.
Mr. President, yeah. Mr. President, we seem to be getting some distressing news from Sao Paulo in Brazil in relation to the Alliance for Progress. Now, the Post had some piece this morning saying that this, an idea has been circulated by which the Alliance would be made worldwide with the participation of Eastern European countries and the Soviet Union in this to help the Alliance reach its goals. Can you tell us in principle what you think about it?
No, I don't. I've never heard of that. And we're not proposing to engage in a joint effort with the Eastern Europeans. It may be that's a matter, of course, of sovereign decision, but I don't regard them as interested at all in the alliance, because the alliance and the Charter of Punta del Este is based upon the development of free democratic societies in Latin America, which is our objective. Their objective is, of course, different. So I don't see how you can join them in the alliance. Yes.
Several months ago, you nominated David Rabinowitz to be a federal judge in Western Wisconsin. Since that time, the American Bar Association has opposed this nomination, and a majority of lawyers polled by the State Bar Association said that he was unqualified. Do you still support this nomination, or in view of this opposition, are you going to win?
No, I'm for David Rabinowitz all the way. I know him very well. In fact, for a number of years, and the American Bar Association has been very helpful in making the judgment, but I'm sure they would agree that they are not infallible. Mr. Brandeis was very much opposed. There are a good many judges have been opposed, have been rather distinguished, and I'm for David Rabinowitz.
President,
yes.
Sir, do you mean to leave the implication by your remarks on the wheat thing that if the Boghorn case is not satisfactory?
No, I wouldn't attempt to. I want to get Professor Boghorn out of prison, and it seems to me the best way to do it is to confine my remarks to what I've said. I'm merely saying, in fact, I won't even say it anymore.
The senators from New England met this morning in the office of Senator Kennedy.
and agreed to renew their annual appeal for relief on wool and for the lifting of restrictions on residual oil. What can you do and what will you do to help the people in New England on these problems?
Well, as I understand it, on one case, there's a desire to limit imports, and the other is to encourage imports. So that we're... I used to take part in those meetings myself. On the other hand, and there is a matter of concern. As a matter of fact, yesterday I met with the head of the coal producers, coal association, very concerned about the imports of residual oil. But it is a fact that the imports of woolens and worsteds have gone up from about 15 to 22 or 3%. So there has been a sharp increase, and it is a matter of concern. In the case of residual, we are attempting to, that's a matter of great interest, as you know, to Venezuela, which is a country that's under communist attack. And therefore, we have to consider that obligation as well as our obligations to the domestic coal industry. So we have not forgotten New England.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you.
And that was the last press conference, the last news conference that John F. Kennedy ever had. It took place last Thursday morning. We'll be back with more until 1 o'clock on NBC shortly.
The NBC Radio Network will stay on the air with continuous coverage until 1 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. We will resume broadcasting at 7:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, Saturday, tomorrow, with continuous coverage. We pause 10 seconds for station identification.
The Detroit News Stations, WWJ and WWJ-FM, Detroit.
That press conference that the president gave, I think the most poignant thing so far as I was concerned, and I'm Joseph Michaels of NBC News here at Radio Central now, was the remark by one of the reporters referring to him in connection with Margaret Chase Smith, but referring to Mr. Kennedy jovially as a possible candidate. It hit me, probably you. You think of the things that our new president, Lyndon Johnson, has to face, and I think this news conference brings them all out with tremendous impact. I was just noting down a few as they went along. These are things on which the president of the United States, with the most responsible job of any single individual in government anywhere in the world, has to be intimately concerned and has to have huge knowledge. For instance, there was reference made to the import of woolens and worsteds, their impact or strength of impact on various parts of our country, but also on our lives. Such things as residual oil. What does the importation of it mean to New England? The president has to have an answer. The nomination of a federal judge in Wisconsin. Many times in the past, there have been presidents who might not even have remembered the individual, but nowadays a president has to. All of these vast problems that the president will have to face. The Central American problem, what we do about Latin America. When there is a change of government by revolution, do we recognize that country or not? Do we continue our aid to it or not? The entire question of foreign aid, Mr. Johnson has this placed firmly in his lap. An anti-missile that the Russians may have, what does the president know about it? The reporters will ask. Medicare, when will it be passed, if ever? Will Mr. Johnson continue the strenuous support of it? The tax cut program to which the president, Mr. Kennedy, was so firmly committed. Civil rights, which has been an important issue, and in which Mr. Johnson, although a Texan, has himself participated strongly. The South Vietnamese war, with which we still live. Latin America, the Alliance for Progress, and all the attendant problems growing continually. What do we do about Brazil, with its continued inflation, the government turning farther to the left all of the time, and Argentina, which has taken over oil properties that the United States was involved in. All of the complexities of Middle Eastern governments, which change continually. Is this government, when it changes, a government which is connected with the communists, pro or against them, pro or against us? Indonesia, another question. What do we do about Indonesia? There is France. The expressions of condolences are wonderful, exciting, and touching. But our feelings about France still are there. And then elsewhere in Europe, Berlin does not go away. Berlin is still with us. And fortunately, for a report on that, with us now from Berlin is NBC's John Chancellor.
The Freedom Bell in West Berlin tolled for John F. Kennedy tonight, an expression of the profound sorrow felt by the people of this city for the death of the president. In a remarkable demonstration of public grief, perhaps 50,000 West Berliners gathered well after midnight at the Schöneberg Rathaus, the city hall, to honor the memory of Mr. Kennedy. It was at the West Berlin City Hall on the 25th of June this year. Mr. Kennedy told the people of West Berlin, "Ich bin ein Berliner. I am a Berliner," as he pledged his honor and American honor to the defense of this city. Tonight, weeping Berliners rang the giant city hall bell in his honor. It is called the Freedom Bell, a gift from America, and this is what it sounded like tonight. The meeting tonight was addressed by Mayor Willy Brandt, who knew President Kennedy as a friend of Berlin. Here is what Mayor Brandt, his eyes shining with tears, had to say later to NBC. Mayor Brandt, this must have been a terrible blow to you. You knew him rather well, didn't you?
I did. I didn't believe it when I got the first news. And the Berliners didn't believe it. But it is a fact, it is a tragic blow to the American people. We feel it as a tragic blow to the people of Berlin, people of Germany, Europe, the whole world. And all our sympathy is with the Kennedy family at this moment, with the people of the United States. We remember here in Berlin that only a few months ago, John F. Kennedy spoke to us and said he regarded himself being a Berliner. And tonight, when the sad news came to the city, the students of Berlin interrupted the meeting and said that they would make a midnight demonstration to the city hall in order to express their feelings. Thousands and thousands came together with them in order to express how sorry they all felt, because they think that this tragic blow is something very serious.